a globally respected expert on macroeconomics, development, and international trade. I am in conversation today with one of India's most influential and outspoken voices in economics. You've advised governments, shaped policy, represented India at the IMF, challenged orthodox thinking. So how would you now place yourself in the scheme of things at this stage in your life?
The same as usual. I don't see anything different since I've retired or whatever. I'm continuing to write and write research and journalism articles. And actually, I was, you mentioned bringing data in. That was, I started writing, my first article was in 1980. The Gandhi film was out, and Indians were objecting, okay, why is Attenborough making this film rather than an Indian? So that was the first time the article was entitled In Defense of Attenborough. So I guess my first contra-thinking article came out as long back as 1980. And actually, journalism has been my real love, other than cricket and research.
So when you were part of the Prime Minister's Economic Advisory Councils around 2017, what was the most difficult advice that you thought you had to give in terms of the political context that any political party in office would be concerned about?
The role of an advisor is to tell it like it is to the leaders. And you have to call the fault lines where they are wrong, absolutely, bluntly. And then it's their decision. But I don't think that is the case. I don't think it was fully the case before, and it's not the case now, where the advisors give the advice without any questions. In other words, they try to anticipate what the leader wants to think, which is completely wrong in my opinion. You should give your view. You are the expert. You are the advisor. You have more domain knowledge than the Prime Minister or anybody else has, sure, by definition. So you should do that. But we don't. And part of it, maybe in some other occasion, whether it is in our DNA that we don't want to challenge. In the olden days, you were the expert, but we were going through enormous changes. Any developing country went through an enormous change over the last 40, 50, 60 years. And now the world is, thanks to that little device, the world is now vastly open. And I don't think our policymakers recognize that.
Right.
That,
right.
Listen, you say something or whatever, the whole world will know in 2 minutes. And so you have to be conscious of the changed world that we live in.
All right. Interesting part of your work indicates sort of challenges to international poverty and inequality estimates. I mean, that's been a very important part of your work. Do you believe that we have a problem, India has a problem in communicating this to global institutions? Is there a special challenge that we have in this matter? What's your experience?
No, I don't think we have. I think maybe the institutions have a problem. And I know that the World Bank had a particular problem in the late 90s. And I wrote my first book, Imagine There's No Country, looked at the evidence that the World Bank and others were putting out on poverty. And, the World Bank was acting out of its own self-interest. And this is where we've got to recognize the institutions are no different than you and me. They are composed of people like you and me. They run it, and is, you know, they don't want to be challenged. And therefore, while at the World Bank, and I spent a lot of time there, about 8-10 years, while at the World Bank, you know, there's an open communication between the researchers as well as the so-called policymakers within the bank, but they felt compelled. They need to get money in order to aggrandize themselves as the institution. And therefore, when I challenged the poverty estimates of the World Bank, they saw it as a threat to their fiefdom. That, you know, but that's the problem with, maybe that's why I'm always in trouble. That's the problem with, you know, you look at data. Look, my concentration throughout has been to look for data.
Right.
And, you know, one of the columns that I, title of the columns was Looking for Logic.
So if we take that forward to the focus that we find, fortunately, on India today, in a world that's in turmoil, in a world order that seems to be under stress, constant talk about change in world order, yet there is a focus on India. What is your understanding of the reason of this focus? Is it organic? Is it something that we are doing specially and doing correctly, which is causing this focus to,
no,
to happen?
Very in good and involved question, but in one word, the focus on India is China. China is the one country that has enormously benefited from the rest of the world. And has, and you know, so the rest of the world is now in a position of how do we stand up to this dragon in economic policies. You know, they have about twice as much share of world manufacturing output than the U.S. had at the end of the Second World War. So, you know, when all the countries were decimated, then, and, you know, it's an interesting contrast between the U.S. and China. If you look at around the world today, they are, most countries have a trade surplus with the U.S., and most countries have an enormous trade deficit with China. This is, so I think...
Which is true for us as well.
Yes, which is true for us as well. So if you look at, you know, that I think now, and no country, and this tells you how much benefit China has got from the rest of the world, that no country, including the U.S., can take on China on its own. Now, coming back directly to your question, India is very important in the scheme of things for the world, not just for India. For the U.S., for the EU, for the Western democratic allies, we are a country that can provide, as technology, workers, output, and people. One of the things, you know, one of the least recognized events in the world for the policymakers is the supreme decline in fertility that has taken place around the world. You know, in India, we have a fertility level below 2, which is, and replacement rate is 2.2.
Right.
So this is the big story. And we will have, thanks to the fact that we are reaching the fertility decline a bit later than China, if you will, which had a one-child policy. And so, in other words, we will supply human capital to the world. We will supply labor to the world. And we will supply know-how. So I think there's a perfect union. And indeed, the policymakers have been talking about China plus one. So it's not as if they don't recognize it. That's where India fits in. It's a perfect time for India to exploit its advantage, comparative advantage, which is labor as well as openness, democracy. And this moment is a very interesting moment to discuss that. Because, as you know, there has been all this dilly-dallying going on about trade deals. And we had a trade deal with the EU. We had a trade deal with UK.
Do we know enough now about the trade deal, or we are still in the process of getting to know?
There was a press statement issued by the White House that this is not going to be a business-as-usual trade deal. This is the real enchilada, in my view. I'm making a forecast.
Is there a bottom line on the oil, on the Russian oil? Is there a bottom line?
America wanted us to buy Russian oil precisely because Biden, because that would help keep oil prices down.
Right.
So this was a way, rather than having this great shock to the system, they said, okay, you go ahead and bring about and import Russian oil, which we did.
What is the takeaway for investments? Now, we've had a couple of bad years for investors. We've had people leaving India and going off to the West Asian region, going to Dubai and where have you. Is that going to get reversed? Will that get stopped? And investment climate will improve? How do you see that?
Yeah, I think this is the real deal. And to answer your question, that is a problem in India, is private investment has gone down. Public investment is there and has increased. Private investment in India has gone down from something like 25%, about 10 percentage points decline since the peak years. Real problem. Then we take FDI, which is very, very important and very crucial. One of the first lessons in my first course in economics, which was back in 1970, was that, you know, FDI is a huge contributor to growth because it brings in money, which the developing countries are all in need of, and it brings in technology. You know what the FDI percent of GDP in India today is? The same level as it was in 1990. So the investment climate...
Has it gone up and
gone down? No, down. Okay. We are at zero. Indians are investing more abroad than foreigners are investing in India. And this is, you know, bad due to our bad policy, especially on bilateral investment treaties, the model BIT that was introduced in 2015, which actually requires... or required, since it's now trying to change it, which required that if two firms were to enter into a disagreement, which happens all the time, wanted to enter into a divorce, look, I want to close this relationship, you had to wait 5 years. You had to negotiate. Now, there's no divorce that ever takes 5 years. After that, they said you'll have to go to an Indian judge in order to negotiate or reach a final dispute settlement. So what did the foreigners do? Voted with their feet. They said, we are exiting India. And they have exited India in droves. The second part is on markets, which is, I think, what you're asking. Yeah. What does it happen for a stock market? We all have investments in the... And, we, you know, the stock market is a very good signal of what an economy is doing.
I'm not one... Okay, and that's all right.
No.
Markets are not all right.
No. Okay. The Indian stock market last year, 2025, showed the lowest increase relative to our peers than the last 25 years. In other words, we've never had it so bad. The Indian stock market has never had it so bad. 25 years, that goes back to 2000. So it's never been so bad. So that's why I've been consistently saying that this trade deal with the U.S. is absolutely necessary to bring the market back into our decision-making rather than bureaucrats making decisions, economic decisions.
And what is the timeline that you give?
The time, you know, these markets move very fast now. Economies adjust to the new reality very fast. But I think the real story is employment. The real story is growth in wages. And the real story is in our exports. And
so the 500 billion target in exports is really...
The 500 billion target, there's no timeline specified, but it is assumed to be over the next 5 years, which is 100 billion a year. It includes aircrafts. So, you know, you can quite easily get in. We're already purchasing, and they might rewrite, okay, the Air India has purchased, a couple of hundred billion or whatever the number is. Aircraft is a big proportion, and exports. We will purchase, so if U.S. exports to India go up, that comes within the 500. But I think, you know, I wouldn't go with a precise number. It is symbolic to a large extent.
A million-dollar question, if I put it like that. We are now the fourth largest economy in terms of GDP. We will become third, etc. But that is not the entire story. So what is the entire story about growth and the entire story about GDP? Because per capita GDP is an issue that remains red flagged.
I've never been a big fan that we are the fourth largest for precisely that reason. That is per capita growth in incomes that's really relevant. And so what you want to see is an acceleration in per capita income growth. Now, so let's forget about the fourth largest and third largest. We've got more people than anybody else in the world. So, you know, therefore, by definition, we'll be. It is, as I said throughout both this interview and this discussion and forever, it is the individual growth that matters. We have, you know, and this is something we can take a lot of pride in. If you take China out, India is the second fastest growing economy for the last 30 years. That includes Congress, that includes the BJP, that includes alliances, third party, etc. We've done well in terms of growth. Okay? Since 1991, we have done exceedingly well, better than all except China. And China has been specially privileged, and maybe they are better than all of us put together. Let that be. I am still very proud of the fact that India has done second best. Then you take in terms of living standards, which is like poverty reduction, infant mortality, education parity between boys and girls, as well as the average level. You take all those indices together, India has done better than almost any country in the world. Again, excluding China, because we don't even know about that data. Now is the time for us to accelerate the rate of growth. It's not as if we haven't done well. It is that we can do much better. The whole idea of any development and any policy is, what does it do to your potential rate of growth, and therefore what happens towards your achieving the potential. Our potential rate of growth, as the CEA also announced, is now somewhere around 7.5% total. Population growth is about 1% and declining. So we are already at 6.5% of GDP, of per capita growth. We need to get it to 8.5% on a sustained basis for the next 25 years.
You've commented recently on the budget, and with an exception of retrospective tax, you've said that you're happy with the budget. So in terms of what you're telling us about the expectations for the future, is this the right kind of budget that we need for that? And are we in place with the other policies that go with budgetary policies that would take us on that path that you're suggesting?
On the monetary policy, and this goes back to the heart of my, if you will, disappointment with Indian policymaking over the last 25 years or so. We've been very conservative in monetary policy. And we have very high real policy rates, very high repo rates in real terms. For example, the repo rate in India is now about 2.5% real, which is about the highest we've ever been. East Asia, you look at their real policy rates. Their real policy rates have averaged somewhere between 0 to 1%. We are 2.5 times that. So I think I was very disappointed in the policy announcement where they didn't reduce the repo rate. I think one of the outcomes that I'm hoping, and I'm emphasizing hoping and therefore expecting because of the trade deal, we'll be a little bit more mature in our reducing our policy rates so that growth can happen for MSME, the usual story.
What are the factors that you look at when you take a call on the rate?
So very simple, the real policy rate is nothing more than the rate at which the RBI is lending, the repo rate, the banks get it, and the inflation. Well, I think one of the biggest stories in the world for the last 25 years, and excluding the 2 or 3 years because of COVID and all the nonsense, is a decline in inflation rates around the world, including in India. Remember, between 2004 to 13, we'd reached something like 9, 10.
Yeah.
Now it is 2%, 1%, and I don't think it's going to go much higher. So my point is that the government, that the RBI, should realize this story internationally and domestically, and therefore do everything. We are in a very competitive world, and I want the RBI to be forward-looking. How can we help Indian industry, Indian workers, by facilitating their growth? You lose nothing.
But that's not because there is a decline in demand. Inflation moderation is for a variety of reasons.
The story on inflation moderation, to answer you first, not because of decline in demand, it's because of an increase in supply, of educated labor around the world. You look at real wages, whether it's in the US or in Europe or India or developing countries, college-educated workers are getting less and less, okay? There's a surplus. You know, you and I and all of us, let me just say myself, the biggest policy I've believed in is education. And I still believe in education.
Sure.
Okay. Now, what happened? They listen to you. They listen to me. And all governments around the world encouraged education parity between men and women, boys and girls, and encouraged, all of us to get a college education, middle class. The world has become increasingly middle class. And one of the first things a middle class individual does, a middle class mother does, educate, go to college, beta. Okay? We all went to college. So now what's happened? We all went to college. And the wage, you can get a college-educated workers for much less money than you paid some time back. That's the story. That's why inflation is down.
What are the red markers? I mean, what would you say is possible risk as we move forward 10 years? And what are the strengths that we move forward with? And is this something that is clear to international organizations like IMF, World Bank, etc., or they have a different set of views on this?
The reality is we are living in a world more polarized than ever. And oftentimes, I wish the world would get back to a less polarized. World has a capacity for self-preservation, and which is demonstrated through all the crises. And now the capacity to self-preservation is to reduce the polarized. That's the area that I think the world is moving towards. There's a lot of feedback coming in that we have to be a little bit more balanced and maybe get back. So, for example, maybe it's not related to this, in Australia, is it, where they've now, or France, where they've banned, in Australia, access to
phone,
internet
and
for 16 years or younger.
That's right, yeah.
And, I think that's a huge positive step. So things are happening to correct the extremities. around the world, and I think will continue. So I look forward to a much better world than we are in today.
Well, let there be prophetic words that we all live by. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Bala. It's such wonderful talking to you.
Thanks.
Thank you.